Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Emily Fritzi joins us today from Palo Alto. Emily is a partner at the Wesley Group, leading investments in energy, mobility, industrial, and climate companies. Prior to joining the Wesley Group, she was a director at Powerhouse, a climate venture fund in Oakland, where she helped conceive and raise Powerhouse's seed fund and manage Powerhouse's innovation firm. And prior to Powerhouse, Emily was a senior director in the Obama White House, where she managed energy and climate initiatives. Emily also served as a special advisor at the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, better known as ARPA-E, and in policy roles to U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernie Moniz at the U.S. Department of Energy and in the U.S. House of Representatives for Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. And some notable investments she's been able to work with include Impal, Voltaire, Amp Control, and Circulor. Emily, it was great to see you in person at the Fontenelle's Partner Industry Summit in Detroit not too many weeks ago, and I'm glad we could bring that chat online to the pod. So welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Thanks, Ty. Great to be here.
All right. Well, I always give short summary on my introductions, but give us the color commentary on your journey, the various roles I just laid out in industry and venture, and then what led you to where you're at today with the Wesley Group.
Yeah, I had, I think a lot of people say this, but a sort of non-traditional path into venture, which is that I spent the first decade of my career working in policy and politics in a variety of different roles focused on energy and climate, notably as chief of staff at ARPA-E and then in the White House focused on energy and climate initiatives. And through that experience, I was able to get broad exposure to the range of technologies and decarbonization solutions, and especially at ARPA-E, interact with a lot of startups, the investment community. And so as the Obama administration was winding down, I decided prior to the election that instead of trying to stay and work in a future administration, I wanted to be closer to technology deployment into companies that were building solutions, as opposed to, you know, focusing on the macro policy challenges, which are also, of course, very important. So I ended up teaming up with Emily Kirsch over at Powerhouse and helping build that. And, you know, through that, getting a lot of exposure to the, at the time, somewhat nascent climate venture and investor space and entrepreneurs. And then over time came over to the Wesley Group. And I think now, having had the regulatory and the political and policy experience, the technical network from ARPA-E is super helpful as we at the Wesley Group evaluate companies that are focused on incumbent regulated industries and certainly subject to the various policies and regulatory actions of government and municipalities.
Right on. Well, policy may be playing a little bit in this role we're going to have on climate and some of these other technologies. I can't keep up with how many legislations we've passed. And then was it just a few days ago, like $7 billion going to a bunch of hydrogen hubs, something along those lines? So,
yeah,
exactly. It's a great background to have because it's obviously very closely tied to this. And we'll again chat through some of this. But I would love to just set the stage for the discussion with our listeners. Tell us a little bit more high level data points about the Wesley Group generally and the fund mandate, just so that they're thinking about as they reach out.
Yeah, so the Wesley Group is a longtime venture fund started in 2007 by Steve Wesley. The fund was probably one of the first funds focused on climate and clean tech investing back in 2007. And so we now have, since that time, raised four funds and have been investing in climate, sustainability, ESG, and also a number of specific verticals. So today, the fund has a $300 million core fund investing in energy, mobility, industrials, buildings, and some horizontal enterprise SaaS where there's applicability to those verticals, for example, cybersecurity. We also are doing some early stage seed stage investing as well. So really investing anywhere from $500K at the seed stage all the way up to, you know, $10, $15 million at the Series C stage. And we're still really focused on decarbonization, at climate and sustainability, but also looking at automation, digitization, and the disruption of some of these conservative incumbent industries. Similar, I know, to your fund, Ty, and a number of others in the space.
Yeah, well, we're going to come back to all that thesis. Couldn't be more overlap, to say the least. We look up to the Wesley Group, and so I'll come back to all this. But I did want to maybe kick us off here before we dig into all the specifics. Let's do a quick market pulse on the macro growth environment in VC today. And so, you know, the Wesley Group invests in early rounds, as you mentioned, but also backs companies further along in their journeys, later stages, maybe think BC and beyond. And I'm sure there's lots of discussion in your office on Sand Hill Road about where we are with the growth stage venture in many people's eyes, thinking it's near frozen. That's their opinion. But in Q2, let's be more data-driven about that comment. If you remove Stripe's big Series I round or whatever it was, quarterly deal value for the venture growth stage was around $6 billion, accounting for only 16% of all U.S. VC deal value generated in that quarter. And there is one prediction that for all of 2023, growth stage deal value won't even reach the pre-pandemic level of around $40 billion. And all this data, I could not continue to press our leaders or our listeners to read the pitch book in VCA Venture Monitor, where all this deal activity comes out. So big wind up there. That's what all the data shows. But is this what you are seeing and talking about with your partners and co-investors? And is it reflected in the growth stage deals you're seeing that are specific to our shared interests in sectors such as industrial tech, mobility, buildings, energy, et cetera? Just take us into some of those discussions and tell us where you think we are and where we're headed at the growth stage related to this podcast audience, if you would.
Yeah, I think the data that you cited is pretty consistent with what we're seeing in growth stage investing right now. I would say the only exception being that if you look at some of the data, SVB issued a climate report covering the first half of 2023. And if you look at some of the data, it suggests that climate investing has been a bit more resilient across stages, including growth stage, than general tech, of course, taking out Gen AI and some maybe very specific areas. I would say that, you know, I expect that the numbers as we near towards the end of 2023 and 2024 for climate as well at the growth stage will also be more consistent with what you're citing across general technology. So there's no doubt that growth investing is much slower, although there are still some deals getting done. A lot of those deals are getting done with structure. They're also getting done in many companies where they can demonstrate profitability or a path to profitability, reflecting what we're seeing in the public markets, where the markets have moved from high multiples and valuing growth at all cost to looking for profitable, longer term revenue generating, income generating companies. I think we're also starting to see, you know, companies react to that growth market and reducing burn, extending runway, and basically extending the amount of time until they need to go out and raise those larger funds and figure out how they can do more with less capital. And then we're now just starting to see, but I suspect we will see, you know, more flat rounds, down rounds for companies that still may be great companies and have really exciting futures, but were maybe overvalued or raised at very high valuations over the last 2 years.
Yeah. Every board discussion right now is leading into the end of the year is capital efficiency in a lot of ways. And I agree with you. There is a nuance, you know, climate, however, we'll define it here in a minute. Our portfolio company, Harbinger Motors, just raised a $60 million round in the midst of all this. So there, it just has to be the right approach and the, you know, the right way of building your business. And maybe it's an unfair tack on here. The crystal ball question of all is all of these structured rounds, insider notes, bridges to nowhere. I mean, we've all heard the acronyms. Do you have a rough when you think things really start de-thawing more per se at the growth stage, or is it just too tough to call right now?
I think we're starting to see I would say look to the public markets. I think we're starting to see the public markets thaw a bit from an IPO standpoint. And if we start to see the IPO market pick up and we start to see some more positive indications of IPO performance, that growth stage investing will also follow suit and start to improve. So I think that, you know, that's not exactly a crystal ball in the sense of, I think the timing around that has a lot of uncertainty, and the public markets themselves have a lot of uncertainty, certainly with the geopolitical crises happening right now. But I think, you know, if I was to advise or to project what might happen with growth investing, I think it's really, you know, looking at what is happening in the public markets from an IPO standpoint.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. It's a great framework. And, you know, all the people that were knocking that they only had like a 10% float and some of those other nuances, at least it's opening up, right?
In some regard.
So I think that's a good signal. And I think it's a great way for folks to watch, because I think it goes from the public markets all the way down to the seed stage. It obviously has its lag time as well. So great framework there. Okay, well, we'll get us back. We were talking about themes and thesis and all these words we're using earlier. But the Wesley Group was launched almost two decades ago to, in quote, invest in the disruption of conservative industries. And you now define the fund's thesis as focusing on, another quote, digitization and sustainability of energy, mobility, buildings, industrial technology, and cybersecurity. That is an expansive mandate that includes both hardware-enabled business models. You guys were really early into Tesla. You did Vue, Inpal, and Gecko Robotics, maybe more of a new name. But you also did vertical software, Procore, Amp Control, Circular, some that you're involved with. So let's pick back up that discussion from our time together at the Fontenelle's Partners Industry Summit and talk about how you look at and invest in hardware and software business models in your focus areas, given this current 23 environment we were just talking about. You know, is there now a higher bar for hardware-enabled business models versus pure SaaS? And when bits meet atoms, per se, is the right approach? What makes hardware unique, worth taking that additional challenge, capital outlay, risk, et cetera, in these industrial sectors? Would love your take.
Of course. I think the answer, my perspective really involves the history of our fund in investing in hard tech over 15 years. Some of our earlier funds more heavily indexed on hardware, including Tesla, like you mentioned, which we invested in back in 2009. And we've seen great returns from hardware. Tesla is obviously a notable example, but also we're invested in Luminar, the LiDAR company that's now public in our last fund, which was also a great outcome. So we believe there are significant outsized opportunities to invest in hard tech. That being said, I think what we've learned as a firm is that, you know, there's no question that hard tech is hard and requires quite a bit of capital and usually more time than expected to get to commercial outcomes. And therefore, that risk is accounted for. There's also potentially outsized returns oriented around hardware. So there's risk and reward to be considered when investing in hardware. So the way we think about investing in hard tech now is that majority of our portfolio is likely to be in less capital intensive companies. That doesn't necessarily mean software. There's some hardware companies like Gecko Robotics, for example, that requires quite a bit of capital, but is a high gross margin company in a licensed business. And then we will reserve a smaller proportion of our portfolio for perhaps higher risk, but high reward hard tech investments where we think there's the potential for really disruptive and outsized returns. And so I think, you know, we sort of fuse, we are not either or, we fuse an interest in both, but we also take some of the learnings from investing in hardware companies over the last 15 years. I think there's no question right now that every firm is thinking about, as we've discussed, the need to raise capital and the risk of not being able to raise capital in this environment, depending on how long it lasts. So that factors into appetite to take on more capital intensive companies, which, by the way, might also include some software companies. Not all software companies are not capital intense. You know, that's something we're thinking about, but I wouldn't say that we would not invest in hardware on the basis of that, because we, of course, also have a long-term view of markets and of companies. The final thing I'll say is that, you know, when we invest in hard tech or hardware-enabled companies, we're really thinking about, does this company have a near-term commercial market in the next 5 to 10 years. So we would be less inclined to invest in a company that is, you know, perhaps on a 15 to 20 year development commercialization timeframe. An example maybe being an electric aviation. We would be more inclined to invest in companies that have a near-term commercial market, where at some point you can actually see offtake and bank on that offtake. We also, really are looking for those special founders across every company, but especially in a hard tech company, a founder that has a capacity to raise capital. And that is a specific skill set that becomes extremely important when investing in a hard tech company.
Yeah, all great points. And I think John Tuff over at Energize, a good friend, he's very aligned. Like, the commercialization path has to be in the near term, even though we all believe in, you know, the future of some of those other applications, like you said, but the near term commercialization is key. On this podcast, we've had everyone from Lior at Eclipse to Tom at One Ventures. You know, the idea of hard tech and the capital intensive nature in the past, that while it's true, hardware can certainly be a huge moat and it may be capital intensive. But there's also a new way of, you know, hardware can be light, it can be approachable. And I think it was Eclipse and SVB that put out their hardware as a service report that really detailed the metrics you should be evaluating building the business upon. So my point with all of that is all the lessons learned are out there, and hardware investing is approachable, but you do have to appreciate where the capital markets are now and plan accordingly. And, you know, to your point, founders, they better know how to fundraise, because those stories do take a little bit longer, but also equally impactful applications, in my opinion. So always love covering the checkbox there.
Point on that too, Ty, I think,
yeah,
you know, there is a, it's interesting in the space of climate investing, there's, you know, sometimes almost kind of two lanes and styles of investing, which is some funds that are taking on majority hard tech and some funds that are only doing software. And sometimes those funds tend to interact more, you know, for obvious reasons, which is they may interact with who they have more similar interest in. And sometimes it's almost becomes a philosophical debate between software versus hard tech. And I think, you know, the kind of thesis, at least we have, is that it's not necessarily either or. You can see great returns and great fund companies with strong principles in software and hardware. But that obviously when investing in hardware and hard tech, you know, there are some things that really need to be considered because it can be fundamentally different.
I agree. We're right there in your camp. It's not an either or. And Icon in our portfolio is indicative of that. Talk about material science, hardware, software, all wrapped into one. Holy business model, but can be a huge opportunity if you build that moat. So I'll press us forward here, though. Maybe this is one of those questions that's been popping up lately. And, you know, your team brings a lot of deep experience in diligencing and investing in premier innovators that are core to this current climate innovation buzz. And, you know, climate, ESG, green tech, sustainability, it's all kind of coming together, and it's all going to drive a lot of impact into the ecosystem, which our digital industrial listeners know is getting more and more attention. And so the Wesley Group put out a thoughtful piece earlier this year on, quote, the top climate trends to watch for in 2023. I'll make sure I sublink that in the show notes, which spanned many areas from fleet electrification to decarbonization of buildings to learning and upskilling platforms to project finance, just to give some examples. And we couldn't agree at Iron Spring Ventures on all of them. We're invested in almost all of them as well. So, again, long build up here, but these days there are so many definitions of climate tech and buzzwords here and there. With as much history as you guys have in this space, walk us through how the Wesley Group approaches climate tech investing and how this has evolved over time, given you and your team have been, you know, for decades investing in in-market applications that clearly have driven sustainability gains long before the word climate was in vogue versus conservative industries, industrial, traditional industries, whatever it may be. Would love how you think it's evolved and what you think about climate tech.
Yeah, so we invest with an ESG framework, an environmental social governance framework, as opposed to just specifically a climate or greenhouse gas emissions impact framework. And I think that's an important distinction to make, which is there are funds that are entirely indexed on climate investing, and how they define that, and probably how you should define that, is what is either the indirect or the direct impact on global greenhouse gas emissions. And that can include, obviously, things like, you know, carbon removal, where there's very clearly a carbon impact, or things like fleet electrification, where, you know, you are indirectly decarbonized via the transition from ICE to electric powertrains. We have used an ESG framework, which includes the evaluation of the E, the environmental, but also the social and governance qualities of a company. And then within that, climate and sustainability and environmental impact is a significant and core theme of our fund, and, you know, that we're consistently investing in, as represented from a lot of the companies that you mentioned earlier in the podcast. So I think it, you know, it's that is sort of the framework we use, which means that in addition to climate and greenhouse gas emissions, we're also looking at sustainability, business models that drive sustainability and sustainability impact. And then in addition to that, you know, we're evaluating a company based on these, you know, some of the social and governance qualities of the company. And we think that, you know, all of that really helps us assess a company and the quality of the company, the some of the risk associated with the company, and then of course ultimately the impact, whether it's climate and emissions oriented or other types of impact.
Gotcha. And so maybe at the sake of trying to promote again on this podcast, building the ecosystem, making sure we break down all these marketing barriers, other people, should I invest in this space or should I not? The preamble goes, if you have less waste on a construction site, that's one of the largest ESG contributors in the world, that's a good thing. If you move trains, planes, and automobiles around more efficiently and move into more of an EV environment, that's less CO2 emissions. And if you make your factory complex, call it more hyper-local, hyper-custom, hyper-now, that is obviously helping greenhouse gas complexes, things like that of that nature. So again, the buildup, would it be fair to say, Emily, as I like to define industrial tech, digital industrial tech, however we define it in our marketing, isn't that the same, synonymous as climate and sustainability in a lot of ways?
I think it is. I think, you know, it really depends the, you know, really, I think it's an investment by investment basis, right? Like in evaluating a company and actually what they're doing, what is the actual impact or of that company, and from a sustainability and climate perspective. And so I think, you know, part of what we do is in our evaluation of a company, we do assess what is the ESG impact and quality of this company, because every sector and every company is different.
Okay. Well, we always love at some point to bring the discussion back to the founders who are specifically in the arena building, and we want to give them some words of wisdom as maybe they think about approaching venture capital or engaging the Wesley Group. So if we could split it between any keys for success you'd give them as they really jump into those discussions, or a common challenge or two to really head off in the current market environment if they're thinking about raising.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, a couple observations for entrepreneurs on fundraising. I think, you know, before considering fundraising, it seems pretty obvious, but timing is key. I recommend that entrepreneurs really think about if you have the luxury and don't just need to raise, you know, for urgency or for capital, immediate capital needs, thinking through, you know, what is the timing in which I start to introduce these conversations, and can I tell a story around momentum at the time I'm approaching these funds? You know, momentum around the market, momentum around the pipeline and the sales. But timing is really key in being able to tell that story. Second, I think communicate, it's pretty obvious, but communication, fundraising is storytelling to a certain extent. You know, really practicing and honing the ability to tell the story, understand your audience, communicate clearly, succinctly, is very important in the fundraising process. There's people who are outstanding entrepreneurs and operators, but in order to fundraise, you have to be able to convey the narrative of what you're doing. Another thing that's really important for venture funds is, you know, establishing credibility, which is sort of an interesting term, but I think, you know, part of what you're trying to do as an entrepreneur is convey credibility. And if you've worked in the sector that you're building something in, it can be more easy to convey that credibility, but it's not necessarily experience that conveys credibility. You know, I think a lot of what we're looking for is for people to, in absence of that experience, convey a deep understanding of a market and an opportunity, and, you know, and do so in a way where they clearly understand how they can do something different. And so there is a way to do that in the fundraising process, which really involves, you know, one, deeply understanding your market and your business model, but also really doing research to make sure you understand who else is in the market, what incumbents there are, who has tried it in the past, et cetera. Finally, I would say, this seems really obvious, but I see a lot of entrepreneurs, meet with a lot of entrepreneurs who don't want to use a pitch deck. And I think it's, I get it. I think, you know, when you're pitching to multiple times a day to investors, you want to keep it more informal. You want to have a conversation. But I think, you know, one recommendation is to make sure to have those accompanying visuals. And while you can keep it informal, it's really helpful in distilling the sometimes very complex ideas using those visuals in a pitch deck in a narrative form. So those are just some thoughts on fundraising, and, you know, before you go out and talk to venture funds.
Yeah, I really like the last one too, because imagery is something that kind of gets burned in your head, and it's a easier way to remember you and your pitch. Obviously, the data has to be something that's memorable, but I couldn't agree with you more on that one. And I did want to just quickly go back to the team real quick, because we often have this discussion. You know, there's a lot of founders that have come from the clean tech 1.0 era that are now building, you know, the next version, or they're building in the ecosystem where they do have that credibility, to your point. Do you have to see that background and call it the clean tech, climate tech ecosystem in order to get credibility? Or how would you kind of advise this domain experience versus, I know how to build tech and product and I'm now learning to be passionate about this problem? Do you have any bias either way, or how you think about the team construction?
I think we're open to either, you know, and it really depends on the company. I think there's specific sectors where having that deep understanding, networking connection, you know, isn't a requirement per se, but is especially helpful. But we also are open to investing in really strong second-time founders or operators who are just really strong entrepreneurs who are interested in a new sector. I think the important note is being able to convey a deep understanding and maturity around what that market looks like and what a solution might look like. You know, sometimes entrepreneurs will come in with maybe a certain amount of naivete about a market. And I think it's really important to have done the work to be able to recognize maybe those challenges or the dynamics of that particular market if you are new coming into it.
Excellent. And then, as we talked about earlier with your background, you know, if they have the humility to learn, they can really accelerate that learning curve with someone who's been living it and understands some of the policy and market dynamics. So I think I'm with you. It can take all types, but you just got to know what you're looking for and what they're looking for out of their partner too. Okay. Well, I think we always like to wrap up the end of the podcast, a little section we call quick hitters, a little rapid fire Q&A. So if you're ready, Emily, we'll jump in.
Sounds great.
Okay, what is the number one thing you look for when you're evaluating a founder who's going to launch a company in this ecosystem?
Intensity and mental flexibility. Sorry, I named two.
It's all good. Tell me a little bit more about mental flexibility.
Mental flexibility means the ability to see things clearly and adapt quickly. Part of being a strong entrepreneur is adjusting to the circumstances that are thrown at you in real time or very quickly, and being able to respond. So I think we're trying to understand, does this person have an awareness? Do they have the ability, if needed, to see where the market's going and adjust accordingly? Do they have the ability to really hear or listen to customers and what they're saying instead of just, you know, charging on or marching down some course? And so that's, you know, a more qualitative attribute that we are evaluating in the process.
I like it. And when paired with intensity, that would be quite the ride there. I like it. I hadn't heard that one before. Okay. Well, what is one resource? It could be a book, podcast, blog, whatever you'd recommend our audience to follow in this ecosystem.
I'm sure this has been thrown out there before, but, you know, for anyone interested in technology, investing, venture funds, entrepreneurialism, the Acquired podcast is just outstanding. I think, you know, especially in understanding the kind of different tactics and approaches to venture, but would highly recommend.
That's a great one. One person who should be on the show helping us build ecosystem further here.
I would recommend speaking with Raj or Anoop at Activate Capital. They are also a longtime fund that has been investing in climate, but also specifically industrials. So if you haven't featured anyone there yet, would highly recommend.
You are spot on. They're on the go get list. Another great shop to put on this show for sure. And then finally, the best way for folks to reach out to you after this.
Feel free to reach out over LinkedIn. I actually respond to messages and connections from new contacts. So feel free to find me, Emily Fritzi, on LinkedIn, and look forward to connecting and following up.
Love it. LinkedIn is incredibly powerful. It's probably the most understatement of my career. So I love that. it's powerful in a lot of ways. Well, great. I know this started with some Fontanelle's Summit conference discussion and lots more discussion ahead. And at some point we need to get, you know, we need to rally the digital industrial broader masses troops together and have our own summit. So Emily, appreciate all the back and forth, and we'll look forward to finding the first one to work on together.
Sounds great. Thanks, Ty.